If you're a strong woman in my environment, you're a problem. So I'm a hell of a problem. I don't have time, an awful lot of time for hobbies, but keeping alive one of them.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Scores of teenagers left on the scrap heap living rough in empty city centre office blocks. Our future, just hidden casualties of the housing crisis. Well, you write what they want you to write, with free food and drink. The predictable G7 meeting in Bavaria was the journalists' heaven, but it quickly turned to hell last week for the handful of journalists trying to cover NATO's biggest banksters and corporations' secret after-party, the Bilderberg. Where anything can happen, and it's nice if you can actually do your job. Meanwhile, the Daily Mail this week claimed that only 5% of one of Britain's British cities' beggars are homeless, like blaming Muslims, of course. That's just another lie. The Daily Mail's job seems to be to blame the victims. Bristol's 15,000 people officially registered as homeless, and with benefit sanctions, the bedroom tax and evictions last year at the highest in Britain since records began, the queue, of course, is growing. But Bristol's hundreds of homeless youngsters are not going to sleep out in shop doorways. So, as Ken Clark made squatting residential homes illegal when he was Justice Secretary, scores of 18 to 24-year-olds are now banding together and sleeping in hidden office squats in Bristol. Like the former probation office De Courcy House near Brunswick Square, for example, brought back to life by scores of Bristol's invisible, discarded youth. Faced with a government that cares more about rising house prices than housing anyone that can't pay for it, we're joined by Green councillor from Lancaster, Chris Coates, who's actually been building the houses and communities of the future. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the Politics Show. Tell us a bit about what you've been up to in Lancaster then.
We started off in Lancaster with initially a very small group of us looking to build our own eco houses. That was where the project started. There was actually no way that half a dozen of us could compete with developers, and we were talking 2005, 2006 here that the project started.
You're talking about competing with them to buy the land in the first place?
To find a plot to build your own house. It was just ridiculous. The overheating of the housing market just pushes anybody out who is not a big developer. The developers are land banking potential sites, even if they're not building on them, and there's no way you can compete. So we started to look at how you might band together with more people. And I mean, the initial project was self-build. I'm a carpenter, my background. We were going to literally build our own houses, but we couldn't find the site. So we looked more and picked up this sort of Scandinavian model of co-housing, and got away from the actual self-build, the bricks and mortar, pick up your tools. And eventually got a group of 15 households, families, single people, number of retired people looking to build some decent eco housing. And that started to give us the sort of clout where we could go and talk to a bank, start to look serious to people, to developers. And if you like, we were lucky when the market crashed. In terms of, we were in a position to buy a site as other developers were going bust, because they'd gambled on the height of the market.
Well, you know what? It's almost making me feel like it's a hellishly difficult thing to do. And
it is.
Even when you, how many people were you altogether?
We were 15 families, 15 households at that time, so 30 adults. I mean, we've and we were looking for a site for 15 to 25 houses. In the end, what we've built, we got a former industrial site, amazing location on the banks of the River Lune, just outside Lancaster, and have ended up building 41 eco houses and a number and converting an old mill building into offices and workshops.
But I bet, I'm sure there's people driving home there or listening at home tonight who go past places. They think, why is that site not being used? You know, in a similar way to you've done. So you managed to sort of surf the crash and buy at that time, did you?
Yes, if you like. I mean, there
was an
interesting
crash. It wasn't a crash, was it? Let's think. It was a bailout. But yeah, certainly, you know, there was a lack of confidence.
There was a housing market confidence crash, if you like. All the sites we were looking at were withdrawn from the market. No owner of a site was going to sell in a falling market. Only somebody who had to sell, so literally somebody who'd over gambled in terms of what money they thought they were going to make, suddenly disappeared. We were the beneficiaries of somebody else's bad luck, if you like. And I'm not sure we would have managed it without that.
How much does it cost to buy land then?
It's about a third of the house. I mean, it's different in different parts of the country. It's no good.
No. I mean, in Lancaster, it's different to here, obviously.
Yeah, but it's a third of the cost of a house. So if it's a £300,000 house, somebody is trying to get £100,000 for just the site. That's the sort of thing.
But I mean, an ex-industrial site like the one you've got, surely that's going to be going for a bit less than that, rather than something that's already been scheduled for housing.
I mean,
because did you have to do any negotiation over planning, that kind of thing?
The site had planning permission. The previous developer had planning permission, not for what we wanted to build. So we knew that the planners would look favourably on a housing development on that site. And we'd spent 5 years looking for a site, talking to the planners. They knew what we wanted to do. In some ways, we'd already done the groundwork with the planning department. No, planning wasn't a problem. The risks we were taking were potential contamination on an industrial site. That's why you get an industrial site cheaper. I mean, the day we took possession of a whole load of derelict factories on the banks of a river, you do sort of sit there going, right, well, we have to do something now. And we're not property developers. I mean, the biggest difficulty was treading that line between a sort of group of community activists wanting to self-build their own houses, be sort of a nice, friendly community group, and having to act as property developers. And those two worlds do not mesh very easily.
So how did you get on with the people who you were commissioning to build the place and design it?
We very early on, we had some architects on board who had a background in Scandinavia. They'd studied the Scandinavian model of co-housing. It's an architectural model as much as anything else. It is a sort of design concept where you're trying to maximise social interaction between people. So the model, I mean, our houses look like ordinary houses. There's nothing sort of eco, sort of, I know.
Well, the interesting bit is the bits you share, isn't it? I mean, because I know, for example, you've got a bit sort of common room where you quite regularly eat together in there, or there's communal meals prepared. And also, the thing that amazed me almost more than anything else was you've got your own like little shop.
Yeah, the model is that the theory behind it is you downsize, you get rid of your spare bedroom that's either full of junk or you only use at Christmas when the relatives come, and you use that sort of capital and you invest it into some communal facilities. So as you say, we've got a big sort of what I call, it's like having a clubhouse or a community centre for just one street. We have a laundry, as you say, a little sort of food co-op type shop, two guest rooms, children's playroom, and quite a lot of shared garden and sort of outdoor space. And that's the concept, and it's designed to maximise sort of contact between people. So vehicles are kept to the side that you can't drive up to your house. It's completely pedestrianised development, with a little car sort of park at one end, and it in some ways your houses are designed back to front. Our kitchens look out on the front street, really. The idea is that people spend a lot of time in their kitchen, and you get this contact by people walking by. It's interesting. I'm not sure that the Scandinavian lifestyle fits as over in.
Well, I wonder. I'm not sure whether it's that this kind of thing has developed in Scandinavia, because the winters are pretty harsh. I mean, if you've got a small group of people living together, then they do need to be fairly self-contained. They do need to have a bit of space where they can all sort of interact with it, and maybe have their own shop, their own laundry. Then they can't necessarily travel miles to a town centre when they're iced up and snowed in.
Possibly that was a driver that started that. I mean, it's now a sort of European-wide movement, and as sort of jumped the Atlantic, and I mean, you get co-housing movements in America and further afield, Australia, New Zealand.
I mean, what's this present government, how do they figure? Is this anywhere on their radar, this sort of thing?
Not really. I mean, the housing bureaucrats have taken interest in it, because, I mean, we've had a number of people from housing associations come and have a look around. And in some ways, we've sort of touched the holy grail of housing associations, in that we are, in fact, a self-managed housing association, where there's no professional housing officers running it. We run a housing estate. The residents run it. And that's the sort of thing that they've never achieved. They've never managed. The whole housing co-op movement tends to get professionalised, gets away from the whole original idea of sort of people managing their own housing.
Now look, if you've got 15 or so families all trying to agree on how the development is going to take place,
I mean, get 15, we've got 41.
Right, well, but I mean, surely they're not going to agree. You can't get that many people to agree.
We manage an open democratic process.
I mean, certainly with the, you know, once you bought the site, actually getting an agreement about what's going to be built on there, how did you manage that? Because that must be a nightmare, especially when you've got a lot of those people quite idealistic about what they want to do.
We were very clear from the start that we were not grand designs. This wasn't a way to get your dream house. And in fact, we learnt from a previous project. There's a similar project in Stroud, which was the first new build sort of co-housing project in the country. And they'd got into real financial overrun problems. I mean, it did get built and finished, but they got into serious financial problems during the build, because they allowed people to sort of customise their home as a sort of dream. Your grand designs.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because Stroud was quite a pioneer in the sort of pre-industrial revolution as well, wasn't it? And they pioneered this too. So how did you learn from their mistakes then?
We basically told people, we did the sort of Ford motor car thing. You can have any sort of house as long as it's the one we're building. And we said there will be basically a two-bedroom, three-bedroomed house, bedroom flats, and they will be all the same. And if you want something different, we suggest you change it after you've bought it. If you want to customise your house, and everything, every single house would be the same. So we became a sort of small housing developer. There was some input into the overall concept of design, but once that was set, that there was no choice. And interesting things happened. We thought the biggest area of argument would be kitchens. So we offered people a standard kitchen or no kitchen, and you could, if you were a DIY, you could fit your own, or you could spend 10 grand on your super duper if you've got 10 grand to spare on a kitchen. And interestingly, what happened was a lot of people, I think I might do my own kitchen. When they saw the price of a standard kitchen, they went, I can't beat that. Because if you're buying 35 kitchens, you get them at a very good price. So we also found that we were getting really good prices for doing it this way. So you were getting a good deal from the builders, not just because they were in a recession and they were happy to be working, but because you were getting some real sort of benefits of the scale of the project we were doing.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we are backing away from the kind of thing that Chris is talking about here, that he's achieved up in Lancaster with the present government. They seem to be quite keen on allowing planning permission for the big developers and seeing that as the way forward, high cost housing as the best way. And they also they've been reining back immensely on the amount of grants they've been giving to housing associations, less social housing. So how on earth are we going to deal with this if the only objective of the present government seems to be to try and keep the house prices up?
Well, I mean, it's criminal what they're doing, actually. I mean, they're forcing housing associations, who are supposedly independent organisations, and telling them what to do with their assets and their housing stock, which, of course, is completely ridiculous in a situation where we've got such a terrible housing crisis. I mean, what's this kind of social makeup of the people that you have in your... I mean, the housing associations obviously have ended up housing a lot of people in social need, because that's what their mandate is. What would you say about your setup?
I mean, the pattern of co-housing development across Europe from the original Danish has been that the early schemes, and we're in that phase in this country, are all privately financed. Yeah. So it's people who've got some money. If you like, we are doing something imaginative with the capital that people have got tied up in their houses.
Yeah.
So in terms of our social mix, we are missing we're missing the 20 to 30 year olds who can't afford to get on any housing market. And that we see that as a bit of a failure of the scheme. And there's a small site that might come up for sale close by, which we fantasize, shall I say. Let's say we've got no further than plan than that, in terms of we might be able to do something affordable on that. We've got a very broad cross section. Other than that, we've got young families, we've got people who've got kids, teenage kids, we've got people in retirement, we just had somebody's 80th birthday. We have got a whole age range, and we very specifically wanted to recruit that. We actually reserved some of the houses for families. We could have sold them all to a much older age, people who've basically paid their mortgages off, who saw this as a good way to retire in some ways. So that they were attracted to that. But I mean, it doesn't address the issue that Tony brought up right at the beginning, is the people out on the street. And I mean, that my background in housing is that's where I started. I was a squatter in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And yes, commercial buildings were being squatted back then. I mean, when I was in London, there were squatted hotels. In fact, the biggest, longest squat was in the Cambodian embassy during the Pol Pot regime, because they just abandoned their embassy and people took it over. It was run as an art centre with people living upstairs. It was actually one of the longest running squats in the country.
In a way, squatting's bound to be a kind of growth industry in a time like this, isn't it, where people are there's so many homeless. I mean, you know, the figure's about 15,000 on the housing list here in Bristol. That's just the official figures. There are a lot of people who just don't bother even signing up to that, because they know that it's going to take them years and years to come anywhere near the top of the queue to get housed. And actually, the list is growing much faster than there is places for people to go. So a lot of people have just completely given up with that system, and they're working completely outside it, Martin.
Well, yes, and of course this is a rather sinister development. I think the government are quite keen to create a footloose underclass which doesn't have a stable stake in the society and doesn't, in fact, participate in elections. They've changed
This is normal in countries like Mexico, actually, isn't it?
It's normal in countries like the United States, where the last congressional elections there was a 30% turnout. The stable, well-housed 30% of the population. Yeah. And, of course, what you've actually got in the US is people living in tent cities, sleeping in cars, and so on. And you know, we are going to get more like the US, and the US is going to get more like Colombia, Brazil, and you know, it's not a present prospect, is it?
Well, the subject of housing came up on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions, where I think it's Heidi Alexander asked a question to George Osborne, who was standing in for the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Under this government's leadership, the construction of social rented homes has fallen to a 20-year low. But since 2010, the amount of housing benefit paid to private landlords has risen by £1.5 billion. Does the Chancellor understand the connection, or would he like to come to my next advice surgery so my constituents can explain it to him?
Well, first of all, of course we're aware there is an acute housing shortage in London, which is why we need to build more homes. But I can tell the Honourable Lady this. We built more council housing in the last 5 years than in the entire 13 years of the last Labour government. And I'm very happy to come to Lewisham, where we will talk about the fact that today the claimant count is down by 25% over the year, and long-term youth unemployment is down 45% in the last year. The economic plan in Lewisham is working.
Well, obviously, the economic plan, we'll just leave that for the fairies. I mean, that's not really relevant to what we're discussing. They're in denial about this, the problems that housing is creating. And of course, it's not just a housing problem. It has a macroeconomic effect as well. One of the things that's driven Scottish nationalism, for example, is the so-called stop-go cycle in the British economy, whereby as the economy picks up from recession and starts to sort of create jobs, house prices rise, then interest rates have to rise in the southeast of England to suppress the house prices. Meanwhile, places like Blackpool or Glasgow have only just started to put people back into work, and immediately the economy is slammed into reverse. And this is exactly what's going to happen with, it's what I call the inflationist block in the southeast. The property developers, the landlords, the buy-to-let people.
Why inflationist?
They're inflationists because they want prices to rise, that they make their money, and think of all the things like DIY shops and so on, that they all make money out of this property-based economy in the southeast of England. But that property-based economy in the southeast of England is what's eviscerated the manufacturing base of the country north of the Wash. And that's one of the reasons why the Scottish Nationalists have gradually clawed their way into a dominant position in Scottish politics.
Now, Chris, you're not just a carpenter and a developer, you're also a Green councillor. What are your thoughts about how nationally we could deal with this problem? It's just not acceptable to have scores of 18 to 25 year olds with nowhere to live who are grouping together, taking over a building, and have got no kind of stable background. There should be something more for them than that, surely.
I mean, looking back to sort of when I was 18 and left home, went to London, and got involved with the squatting movement there. What actually happened was the accommodation crisis then drove local councils, GLC in those days, to actually do something about it. And to look at sort of, And it was the boom for the housing co-ops. Taking over stock. And it was that the squatters and that clear moral ground, as much as the sort of press tried to vilify the squatters, there was a lot of support. They would pick on the one squatter who'd sort of done some damage to the house, but for every one squatter in those, there were 100 who were genuinely homeless and in need of housing and a lot of support, both politically and from the general.
Well, many squats became housing co-ops. Yes. I remember it was an absolute progression. So people come off the street, go into a squat like Villa Road in Brixton,
absolutely.
And up in the north London in Islington, and the housing co-op, the GLC era, the GLC basically empowered these groups of people to house themselves. Yeah. And it's a no-brainer to me. They should be doing it now.
Yeah, I mean,
but they're not.
In a way, what's happened with Ken Clark stopping residential squatting is he's saying to young people, to anybody that's homeless, basically, it's no good just with a couple of people or just on your own squatting a house. You're going to have to get together with a bunch of, you know, a sort of small platoon of you to take over a building. And in a way, he's kind of bringing people together, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, when I moved from squatting, I moved up north to Lancashire. I mean, we were a small housing co-op. We bought an old industrial building. At that point, we actually discussed whether the next generation of derelict industrial buildings would be the tin sheds that were being put up everywhere. These would be the buildings that people would move into. We actually discussed it 20 years ago, that would be the next wave, because eventually you run out of old mills that you can do up, the sort of 50s, 60s industrial buildings. So, I mean, perhaps this will drive a new wave of co-ops. You can't see any other way out. I mean, you could argue that actually you could extend the current government's policy and suggest that the right to buy should be extended to private landlords.
Well, indeed. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, why not? That would be an interesting extension of the current philosophy. Yeah,
but they're not going to do that, because this is what I'm saying about the inflationist bloc. The Duke of Westminster, for example, the biggest landowner in Britain, every time house prices rise, I mean, people get free money, even if they're just lower down the housing ladder. Imagine the amount of free money he gets as the house prices rise. And, you know, he's not going to
want his tenants buying him out at a discount, is he?
No.
So, in a way, what I suppose we're saying here is that there is a positive side to this, in that at least young people, rather than just being left on their own, there are some places for them to go. And also, obviously, this is politicising people, isn't it? Saying, well, what has this government got for me if it's not going to provide anywhere for me to live, even?
Yeah, and you're starting to see, I mean, I'm on my way to Portugal. I've been looking around at what's going on in Portugal in the housing market. And, I mean, apart from the fact that there are a lot of people who have moved from this country because they can afford to buy something in Portugal, the austerity that has been forced onto sort of southern Europe is forcing people into communal solutions, and they're looking. I mean, you can hardly say it's a good thing that this is being driven, but there are positive outcomes potentially.
Martin, the thing that's almost most worrying about this is this whole idea of, and you were talking about this just after the general election, that there's less and less people now registered to vote, even though we've got a much larger population than 2010.
Well, that's certainly been true in Bristol West. There's been a population increase, but less people are registered to vote. And what the government are doing, effectively, it's what they call voter suppression in the US. Poor people are not encouraged to be active citizens. And of course, if you deprive people of a place to live, and you give them a council tax bill if they're in work, there's a very strong incentive. I mean, in the house where I live, there's about four or five flats. I think I'm the only one registered to vote in the whole in that block. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, it's actually illegal, and you can be fined up to £1,000 for not registering to vote, in theory. But nobody's ever taken to court for it. Yeah. And of course, the other thing they're going to do is redraw they were going to do this, but the Liberals put the kibosh on it. Redraw the constituency boundaries, reduce the number of MPs to 600, but it will be done on the basis of the existing electoral registers, which we know, particularly in the inner city areas, to be woefully weak. And of course, once you've redrawn the boundaries on the basis of those electoral registers, you've permanently disenfranchised a large proportion of the population. And what was mentioned earlier, when David Osborne was going on about the 13 years of Labour government and not building any council houses, he's right. They should have done something. They didn't do anything. Yeah. And they would now admit, we should have done something. And of course, it was running against the grain of this whole thing of giving, you know, people buying their own council houses was a rubbish policy. It was a rubbish policy initially, and it's still a rubbish policy. Although those who benefited from it, who were basically given hundreds of thousands of pounds apiece by the taxpayer, they think it was brilliant. But it wasn't brilliant. It was a stupid policy. Well, and they should never have pursued it. It should never have been pursued.
And a lot of those council houses have now fallen into private landlords' hands.
Indeed.
Those former council houses.
Yeah. The backdrop to this is just rents seem to be going ratcheting up and up and up and all the time. Just heard this week, the average monthly London rent is, would you like to guess, £1,500 for the first time. That's the average in London. Works out around about £18,000 a year just for to rent a place. That means that you're not actually, I mean, that £18,000 out of your salary just for your rent just seems astronomical, Chris.
Well, yeah, I mean, even not recently, there's been stories of people like fire officers who have to live way out of London to be able to afford, because the wages that you get on sort of ordinary jobs just do not pay that inflated, not just London. I mean, it's not just within the M25. It now ripples out. I mean, you've got people commuting in from Leicester and places.
Other than just banning eviction, right? Because that's not an impossible thing to do. It's happened in some parts of the world. Yeah. I mean, for example, in Gaddafi's Libya, you were guaranteed somewhere to live. You couldn't be evicted unless you had more than one home. You couldn't be evicted. If you had two homes, you could be evicted.
Evicted from one.
Yes, but I mean that's you know, there's a fairly radical way of doing things. But I mean, what are your thoughts about a political plan to deal with this? Because we cannot go on forever using the housing market as just a bubble to try and pretend the rest of the economy is working.
A lot of people are going to lose a lot of money at some point, because you're right, it can't go on. And that's going to be a lot of ordinary people. I mean, that's going to be a lot of people who have got mortgages. And I mean, I can't see any way out. I mean, we are building and building a bigger and bigger housing bubble. And I don't know what it will be that will prick that bubble. But I mean, that's going to be the sad story.
I'd like to just for a bit of fun compare how much it costs to build one of your homes on your place up in Lancaster with that £18,000 a year that people have to pay to rent a place. I imagine it's two bedroom place in London somewhere, right? You know, as an average. So how much were the places did it actually cost to build them? Forget for a minute the actual cost of the land, the actual build.
Okay, I mean, we were selling a two-bedroomed house for £190,000. That included having paid for the communal facilities and quite a lot of infrastructure. So the actual house build is probably coming in at £60,000 to £70,000. The bricks and mortar of that actual house. Some of it is then on, you're going to have to pay on utilities. So, but say 10.
I mean, that seems so bonkers to me. Houses don't last 4 years, do they?
No.
I mean, you know, that's if you add up that four years of rent.
We're talking about our houses built to a very high standard. I mean, that's not your Barrett's house cost, and that's not your standard builder's build costs. I mean, we have got houses that we've done what I've always, as a builder, whenever anybody's asked what should we do in terms of environmental impact, I've said you should invest your money in saving your bills in the future. So in reducing that sort of cost to you in the future, because that will make most sense to you in your pocket. It will also make most sense environmentally, because regardless of what your carbon footprint or your energy footprint of building the house is, the 50, 60 years of its life at least.
Your life. The house might live longer.
Well, but we were asked by our architect what sort of material life we thought our houses were going to be, and we said, how about a century? And he said,
well, how about a millennium?
He said usually that the brief is for 25 years.
Wow, amazing. But Martin, we're in this sort of bonkers situation here where people are paying. I mean, we've done a sort of rough kind of back of an envelope.
Yeah.
You're paying for a house in 4 years if you're actually paying for the rent in London. And yet, you know, that's just totally unrealistic. We're supposed to live in a so-called market economy where things cost what you pay for them, but it's clearly not happening with housing.
Well, the thing is that housing and land in any case doesn't function. The supply of land is fixed.
And is it just because we need a house so much that they can jack the price up?
It's all location, 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 yeah, isn't it? Which is why Henry George put the idea of land value taxation as an idea in the last century. and there's still people talking about it. It's basically the Duke of Westminster, even after a crash, he's going to be massively wealthier at the end than he was at the beginning. He'll lose some money in the crash,
yeah,
but he'll have made an awful lot more money than he had at the beginning. So in other words, there's no incentive on those kind of people to change the way the setup works at all. But in actual fact, the value of land rises according to the level of economic activity that's going on around it. So the economist Ricardo pointed this out in the 19th century, saying, well, look, actually, landlords don't do anything. It's a, this is what's called rent seeking. They are actually in a position to basically sponge off the rest of the society. The Duke of Westminster doesn't have to do anything to get richer and richer and richer. And of course, people on the lower levels, like we had the UKIP councillor in the other week who bought his own council house, he basically was given by the Thatcher government, you know, several hundred thousand pounds effectively. Yeah. And of course, that made his life a lot better. But that was a public subsidy to him for doing nothing. And of course, you don't really want that. So the argument is that if you nationalise land, then all payments of rent then go into a massive kitty, which can then be used to pay for, you know, all of the things you want to pay for, yeah, health services, whatever. And of course, this is perfectly logical, but the power of the landowning classes has been pretty dominant in this country since 1066 and doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon.
Okay, so it's going to, I mean, we've just been saying, if there is some sort of a crash, things are likely to change. But, I mean, is there really any kind of political move, even if it's within the Green Party, Chris, for some sort of movement on this? I mean, I'm just thinking about the 1930s when we had what was a real crash, not a bailout, right, a real crash, yeah, in the 1930s. Some of the biggest council estates in the country were then, and the government actually said, right, we really need to do something here. And they built massive council estates, I mean, on the outskirts of London, basically extending the city by several miles, building these tens of thousands of homes. We've seen nothing like that after the bailout, Martin.
No, we haven't.
So where's the political move to make this happen going to come?
Well, I mean, you had the World War II, obviously gave it a bit, you know, and the Labour victory.
This is before World War II.
Yeah, well, they started moving. Like, there was a general consensus. Everybody understood that in Japan, they used to have a real consensus about, we don't allow property bubbles. It'll undermine our manufacturing industry. So you've got a whole policy to suppress housing bubbles. But we, in Britain, there's too many vested interests. Once you've got these vested interests in place,
so what's changed since the 1980s? Since they really, you know, the council house building program stopped effectively.
Well, effectively, what we've done is we've stopped supplying low cost housing for low income people, and not surprisingly, they then put into very great difficulties. And of course, if you did have a solid social housing, council housing program, that would in fact moderate house price inflation, because people would have a genuine choice. Mm. And that moderation of house price inflation then means that your wages become more competitive, you can compete in the international markets and so on. So this property obsession in Britain, also it's kind of social engineering by the state to encourage collective selfishness.
Yeah, I mean, the other factor back in the 1930s was that actually, one of the things that was driving it was a fear of potential revolution,
yeah,
in this country. When I was I did some research when I was writing my book on Utopia Britannica, early utopian experiments around the 1930s. If you look at the discussions that were going on in Whitehall at that time, it was down to what is the size of a garden that you need that will keep a man busy enough that after work so that he won't go out to political meetings. They were having that discussion. Mm. How long does it take to keep the working class involved in something that means they're no trouble to us? And so a lot, I mean, it applies to a lot. That was around discussions about allotments as well. We now see allotments as wonderful. We now see council housing as wonderful. There was a dark undertone to the reason these were being pushed ahead. It was to stop political dissent and potentially a threat to that ruling class at the time.
Interesting that you can't really quite grow enough on an allotment to feed your family, yeah, for the year, can,
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
Maybe if it was three or four allotments, you might stand a chance of really, yeah, growing a substantial amount of food. That's absolutely fascinating aspect to it. Look, I mean, this is another dimension to your stuff that you do, Chris, is the book Utopia Britannica. Tell us about a couple of the utopian experiments, communal type experiments that particularly attracted you when you were researching the book.
There are some around interesting ones around the Garden Cities movement, which again is that early 20th century. There's a place that it changed its name a couple of times, which is an interesting phenomena in communities anyway. They change their names. But it was called Soulshot Hall in Letchworth Garden City. And that was very much, I argue that it's a prototype co-housing project, in that it was this funny phenomena where you couldn't get servants anymore. The middle classes could not get decent servants. And so they decided to sort of do a cooperative servant share. And they had their little unit, they had their little flat, and they had a communal house where they could go for meals, but they employed a cook. You could have meals delivered to your room. And Ebenezer Howard himself lived at this place. And it's a very interesting, because a lot of intentional communities are basically set up by the middle class dropouts, middle class. I mean, the hippies were essentially a middle class movement, because they had some resources to put into these schemes. And you can see that in the sort of early 20th century, the same sort of thing. And it lasted quite a long time. There were a couple in Letchworth, and the last one only wound up in the 1960s. And there were a couple that were more egalitarian, where people did the work themselves. They didn't employ servants. And you see that, you can see that continuity of model coming through in what we're doing now in Lancaster.
That's quite amusing, though, that you've got the situation where maybe wealthy people are losing their servants, so they're thinking, oh, you know, we can't do without our servants. We're going to have to get together
and cooperate to.
So we can carry on our nice the lifestyle to which we've become accustomed.
But there was another side to it. They also argued that it was better for the servants, that you weren't having to live in with a particular household. You'd got an employment contract. You weren't a live-in servant. You'd got regular hours. You weren't on call all the time. They were putting, if you like, an employment side, a servant side spin on it.
No, I know my grandmother was in service, and she, I remember her saying how there was lots of gossip amongst servants, particularly about what the higher-ups were up to, and so it was a constant kind of source of entertainment for the servants as to keeping an eye on, and also how some of the wealthy families that they were working for were actually very, very good employers, a bit like, I suppose, the difference between one housing association or one private landlord and another.
Yeah. I mean, the other interesting thread you've got going historically through this sort of movement is the people who decide that for whatever reason they want to get out of the cities and back to the land. And it goes right back to the sort of late 19th century, where people look at with horror in some ways at the sort of slum housing around industrial areas and go back sort of try to buy cheap land out in the countryside.
But history is littered, though, isn't it, with sort of disaster stories, not least of which in Russia, you know, with the Russian Revolution, where there's all these ideals about people going back to smallholding farming, that kind of thing, but then finding they just simply don't have the skills to do it and virtually starving before they come running, crying back to the city.
But, yeah, I mean, the longest surviving secular community, intentional community in this country, a place called Whiteway in the Cotswolds, celebrated its centenary in 1998, set up in 1898, as a on the back of a sort of Kropotkin-inspired back-to-the-land movement in the late 1900s. And they're still going. They don't look like... I mean, they were Tolstoyan anarchists. They were back to the simple life. They bought 40 acres, just outside Stroud, and divided it up. And you were given a plot, and you built your own shack, your shanty house. And they've now developed into bungalows, and over time, but they've still got this sort of community. At base, you have to apply to join. You don't own your property, and I mean. They are sort of an interesting forerunner to the sort of hippie back to the land movement in the 1960s and 70s.
What about the Chartists? Because they're quite close to here geographically, aren't they? I mean, Gloucestershire and into Wales. I think there were quite a few of those Chartist villages. As I remember it,
Course Lawn near Malvern.
Yeah. And as I remember it, they had a lottery of some sort where loads of the Chartists every week would put a bit of money into the lottery, and then all of a sudden, if they were lucky, they'd come up with it basically enough land to live on. Yeah, and also to vote. The key point, because at the time there was a, you know, only landowners who owned over a certain amount were allowed to vote, and if you go there today, you find actually the place is, in a way, I think the Chartists would have been quite glad to see the way it's gone, because a lot of people have still kept their large piece of land, haven't sold it off to the farmer, and are using it either for horticulture or more often for grazing livestock, because it's a lot less work than using it as a small holding.
Yeah, some of them have continued like that. It depends where they are. The ones over in Gloucestershire, and a particularly place near Kidderminster called Great Dodford, where horticulture did carry on for a long time because they were close to Birmingham and had a market. But if you look at Heron's Gate, which is close to London, it has become a sort of gated community. So it does depend where you were geographically again. I mean, London house prices again have driven that. I think the Chartists, I often tell people we are living in somebody else's utopia. The Chartists come and look at today would think it's great. We've got the vote. Everything that was in the charter has been achieved, except for annual parliaments, which maybe we don't want.
but as we were saying earlier, a large proportion of the population is being disenfranchised through economic mechanisms
another. We're going backwards.
And of course that feeds on itself. Just as building council houses in the first place created a solid block of voters for a progressive government, dismantling it means that you're pushing further in the direction of people not having a say in what goes on in the society around them.
And in some way, we've still got that link with property and voting.
Yeah, effectively, yes.
Effectively, because if you're homeless, you haven't got a vote.
Interesting, yes. And so the Chartists, even though they've got their way, haven't quite, because people have been disenfranchised in other ways. So yeah, we need to have a new kind of Chartist movement of some kind, or at least a new vision, which, there are a lot of people thinking about that sort of thing.
I mean, my son thinks we should have the Australian system where the police come and knock on your door if you didn't turn out to vote.
What I would do is say that it's not compulsory, and you're allowed to spoil your ballot paper.
Yeah, there ought to be.
But if we're going to have things like we were talking earlier about citizens' income or something like that, you say, right, this is what you know, if you're getting any benefits of any kind, you will turn up to vote. Which is how they used to run the Roman Empire, you know. You basically, you turned out to vote in the elections. On the basis of that, you then got your free dole of from the government.
Yeah, and there should be a none of the above.
You don't even need to have none of the work. Spoiling your ballot paper counts. We don't force people to vote for anybody, but you will turn up because it's very important that it's the only thing that keeps the oligarchy in check is the possibility of the people at the bottom having been able to bite back.
Well, let's move on to talk about some of the news stories this week. The Chilcot inquiry delay. MPs tell Sir John to publish findings into Iraq war now or quit. Now, this has gone on for a very long time. There was a little bit of a tussle about whether to get this Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war started in the first place, Martin. Why haven't they published it still?
Well, I mean, you'd have to ask Chilcot himself about that. I'm getting inside information from people I cannot name that an element in this is the South Africa's nuclear weapons, which were sold on the black market in the 1990s to the benefit of certain individuals at the top of the Tory party and the Tory party itself, and that David Cameron was involved in this because he went out to negotiate with Arms Corps as a young gopher for the Tory central office. Now, I don't know whether that's the reason that they're not reporting. It's quite likely that if it's a very difficult report to make because the Americans are screaming blue murder, we don't want you saying what actually happened in these discussions. And that would be my guess.
So when are we going to see this? You can chip in as well if you like, Chris.
Yeah.
When do you think we're actually going to see the Chilcot?
I mean, I can see why they want to stall it for a long, long time. I mean, we seem to be in a culture where there's an inquiry called for, and then actually anything that gets down to the truth. I mean, look at the Hillsborough, 26 years for it even to get to this stage. And how many more years before we get a final report on that one? There seems to be a culture that they offer a public inquiry or some sort of inquiry, a judge's inquiry, and then that kicks it into the long grass, and they hope people will, by the time it comes out, they'll have forgotten about it. There won't be the people on the streets like they were protesting about the war. The Stop the War movement will have faded away, and a few people will shout about it when it does come out, and that's what they're hoping for.
And we've also got a similar thing going on with the what I call the VI paedophile scandal as well. Martin, it starts to look like you've got a criminal elite here, actually. People who are worried that, of course, the obvious person here is Tony Blair in the Chilcot. Is he going to be arrested? Is he going to go? We've got African leaders, a lot of African leaders just refuse to have anything to do with the International Criminal Court. They say the whole thing's a farce. But I imagine if the Chilcot inquiry finds that he broke the law in some way or another, international law, over starting the Iraq war, which has been such an utter disaster, that he'll get off scot-free.
Well, I mean, I think there is a criminal elite. Capitalism has become dominated by its criminal faction, those who do not and play by the rules. And I think that is actually a vulnerability, ultimately. When we say these people are criminals, we mean they have Interpol files. But nevertheless, they're very, very good at protecting themselves, as we all know. I think the Chilcot inquiry, I mean, I don't expect anything from these inquiries, frankly. I mean, it's just like, what do you expect they're going to come out with, which is what we don't know already. We know already that they basically conspired to mislead, and the consequence has been millions of people.
I mean, it starts to look like, doesn't it, that the whole business of austerity could be just an attack on people who may be their potential political opponents. We've been hearing here about these thousands of homeless people who aren't voting. The fact that at the general election there were less people voting, than in 2010, even though we know the population is much bigger. So is that what's going on?
Well, yes, Tony. I mean, we cover this week in, week out. There's been a study done by Harvard University of the US. Let's conclude, this is basically an oligarchy. This is not a democracy. And we don't live in a democracy. We never did. But the oligarchic elements in the way that things go on are getting stronger and stronger. The financing of elections in the United States has become a complete farce. You've got to be a multimillionaire to even think of standing for anything. And you're only going to win if you've got multimillionaires backing you up. And that's the norm.
Is it true to say, Chris, you think there is a north-south divide? I mean, you spend most of your time up in the cold north. Well, it's not that cold, is it? Obviously.
No. A north-south divide. There's definitely a south-east versus the rest of the country divide. I mean, I've got friends in the West Country. They would say there's an east-west divide, and it's in the south. There's certainly a north-west divide. A north-south divide in terms of the housing market that we were talking about earlier, certainly in terms of jobs. We see lots of people from Lancaster going south, going to London, looking for work. During the general election campaign, it seemed clear to me that both the austerity discussion and the debt discussion was a smokescreen for not talking about other political problems within the country. And somehow a con has been pulled on somehow making people believe that the government, the sort of macro economy, is the same as your household economy.
Yeah.
And that it's, as an individual, it's not a good feeling to be in debt. And you try, if you could pay off all your credit cards, you would. So somehow it's been said, and you wouldn't run a business like that. You would take a longer view on a business. Business borrows money, it invests money, doesn't see debt as necessarily a something to get rid of, as a problem. And I think we've been sort of distracted by this sort of con trick. And there's something insidious. I mean, I don't behind it, it very quickly leads you into the conspiracy theory territory, and then you're into smoke and mirrors. You cannot see where this who's the criminal, who's not, how do you believe anything you hear on the news?
Well, you get hold of a copy of David Southwell's Secrets and Lies, which is a bit of a Bible, really. You know, all these sorts of things, which he's done a fantastic job in pulling a lot of the. Because there's quite a lot of effort goes into disinformation. That is to say, putting out complete lies and trying to say, well, that's what the conspiracy theorists are talking about this week. But Martin, the Cartier boss this week, we heard, has got a £7.5 billion fortune. He says the prospect of the poor rising up keeps him awake at night.
Well, I hope it does, is all I can say.
He says
he's been reading toss and about turn as much as possible.
He's been reading about changes in labour technology, as well as recent Oxfam figures suggesting the top 1% of the global population now owns more wealth than the other 99%. How is society going to cope with structural unemployment and the envy, hatred, and social warfare? He said, "We're destroying the middle classes at this stage, and it will affect us. It's unfair." So that's what keeps me awake at night.
Well, we were talking earlier about the fear of revolution leading to social reform, and I would hope that that's what would happen. But I think that the propaganda power of the media, you know, the oligarchic media is enormous now. So they framed the term of the debate in the election. I mean, as an economics graduate, I know that the national economy doesn't function like a household budget. And in actual fact, that's one of the first things you learn, is that it doesn't. But of course, most people haven't studied economics. And if the TV tells them that the government's got to balance the books, they try and do it.
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, our sister show Dialects, on here on Tuesdays at noon. This week, you can hear from the first pilot ever to fly under the Severn Bridge. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Cabot Ward, Annie Stafford Townsend. Thanks also to Chris Coates from Lancaster Co-Housing. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very happy week end.